I'm Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, Jill Robbins and Andrew Smith have a story on the National Arab Orchestra based in the U.S. state of Michigan. Faith Perlow explains the difference between the words victim and casualty, and we listen to the story of an eyewitness by Jack London. But first, here is Jill Robbins.
Michael Ibrahim is busy building bridges, but his bridges are not made of steel, and they do not cross rivers. Instead, they are made of music and cross cultures. Ibrahim is the founder and director of the National Arab Orchestra, or NAO. The group is based in the state of Michigan. It aims to preserve and share Arabic music and culture in the United States through its performances and education programs. We want to be an organization that is sort of the cultural representative of the Arab American community, Ibrahim said. At an NAO concert, the orchestra quickly makes connections with its listeners. As the musicians begin to play, Ibrahim moves his body up and down like a dancer. Soon, audience members start moving to the music's rhythm. Suddenly, Ibrahim turns around and faces the audience. He urges them to clap their hands to the beat of the music, and he urges them to sing along with parts of a well-known song from Egypt or Lebanon. With each song, the bridge between the audience and the orchestra grows.
Ibrahim spoke about the need to help people know more about the culture of Arab Americans.
The Arab American community had to face a lot of discrimination just because they're different, like any other minority community in this country. And that was magnified, after the events of September 11th.
He added that after the terror attacks of September 11th, 2001, there was a lot of false information. He said, "There is a huge debate on the meaning of the word Arab and what is Arab culture."
So we're doing this to bring awareness about the culture, build these bridges so that people can have a chance to engage with each other, and then that in turn makes the world just a much better and easier place to live in because people are less afraid.
He added, "I really love to share who I am, and I feel like the best way for me to do that is for me to share my culture. But I also am born here. And what is American culture if not just this giant melting pot of constant immigration into this country that makes it what it is?"
Ibrahim was born into a Syrian immigrant family in Michigan. He said he was able to connect to his family's culture through music and the arts. When he was 10, he spent a year living in Syria with his family. Back in the U.S., he learned to play the oud, a stringed instrument his father played. He then studied both Western and Arabic music. The NAO started in 2009 as a student musical group at the University of Michigan under Ibrahim's direction. Soon it doubled in size and became the Michigan Arab Orchestra in 2010. It changed its name and began playing as the NAO in 2014. In the 2022 to 2023 season, The orchestra played together at 12 events, including a performance at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. Ibrahim noted that the group tries to represent all the countries of the Arab world today. But he said much of the music they play comes from Egypt, Lebanon, Israel, and Syria.
The musicians in the orchestra are diverse. Some were born in the Middle East and moved to the United States. Others are Arab Americans born in the U.S. And some are from the U.S. but have no family connection to Arab countries. The tonal and rhythmic patterns central to Arabic music are different from Western music. So are some of the instruments the musicians play. Throughout almost every song, Arabic orchestras have musicians playing different kinds of hand drums and tambourines. This gives the music a strong rhythmic feel. Two kinds of lutes, the oud and the buzuk, are among the instruments that help give the music its special sound. Another important instrument is the kanun. Ibrahim arranges the music that the orchestra plays. That means he writes down what each instrument will play. Depending on the piece, this can take him anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 months to finish. One of the big goals of Ibrahim and its executive director, Sherry Richards, is to create a year-round school of Arabic music in the U.S. We're keeping this culture alive, and we're building on it and letting it grow in its own unique way in this part of the world, Ibrahim said. You have to share it with everybody. You can't just keep it for yourself. So that's the cross-cultural work, he added. Along with concerts, another way the NAO shares its culture is with its Building Bridges Through Music program. This includes an after-school program teaching Arabic music in the public schools of Detroit, Michigan.
In January, the NAO concert in Washington, D.C. sold out in less than 3 hours. About 1,100 people attended the concert. Richards, the executive director of the NAO, said, "We have over 400,000 followers on YouTube, which is more than any other orchestra in the world." That, she added, really speaks to the reach and the popularity of the music and the orchestra. Ibrahim explained that the arts bring people together in special ways.
I guess there's a case to be made for the place of the arts in spreading democracy. With the arts, you have the ability to bring people from a variety and diverse geographical makeup. It works. We've shown that for the last 15 years we've been doing it.
Ibrahim shared a central reason for supporting the arts. "I think it's really important that people support the arts," he said, "because that's where the soul of humanity resides." I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Andrew Smith.
Hello! This week on Ask a Teacher, we will answer a question
about the difference between the words victim and casualty. Dear teacher, I am Mayor from Columbia. I hope you are well. I would like to ask you about the difference between the words casualty and victim. Thanks, Mayor. Thank you, Mayor, for this question. Both casualty and victim are nouns. They have similar meanings and usually describe people who have suffered in some way. Let's look closer at each word. A victim is someone who has been hurt or even killed because of a crime or natural disaster. Rescuers gave shelter to the flood victims. We often use the preposition of after the word followed by what happened. She was a victim of a robbery. Victim can also mean someone who has suffered because of someone else's actions. The TV show was an interview with victims of religious abuse. Also, a victim does not always have to be a person. The school's theater and music programs were the main victims of budget cuts. Let's move on to casualty. Like victim, casualty means someone who has been hurt or killed. But the difference is in the cause. If that person has been harmed in a war or accident, then they are a casualty. The implosion of the Titan submarine resulted in 5 casualties. We also use casualty with the preposition of, to say that someone suffered because of a situation or an event. The 4 children were the only surviving casualties of the plane crash in the Amazon rainforest. And like the word victim, a casualty can be something other than a person. My succulent plant became a casualty of overwatering. The easiest way to remember which word to use is to understand the situation that harmed the person. If the incident you are talking about was a natural disaster or a crime, the word victim is most often used. If you are describing the damage of a war or accident, use casualty. Please let us know if these explanations and examples have helped you, Mayor. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Faith Perlow.
That was Faith Perlow with this week's Ask a Teacher. Welcome back to the show, Faith.
Thanks for having me back, Dan.
This week you answered a question from Meyer in Colombia about the difference between victim and casualty.
This was a really important question, even though the topic is difficult to talk about.
You mentioned that both can refer to people who are hurt or people who have died. But is there a way to tell the difference?
Not with the words themselves, but through the context or the rest of the sentence or surrounding sentences. There is another word that is used when the person has lived through a terrible event or crime. That word is survivor, and it is often preferred because it has a more positive connotation, whereas victim and casualty are both negative. When people use the word survivor, it refocuses the conversation towards that person, rather than the crime or the person who committed the crime.
So when is using the word victim acceptable?
Victim is still used, especially by law enforcement like police, and in the courts by lawyers and judges. And when we are talking about someone who has died because of a crime or an event, then we still often use victim.
This is some good information for our listeners. Understanding the nuances, or small differences in words, can be pretty difficult when learning a language.
That's right, Dan. It takes time to learn these differences, especially because language is changing all of the time. Even native speakers sometimes do not know or even realize the differences or changes.
Thanks for taking us through a more in-depth look at these words, Faith. See you next week.
Thanks, Dan.
The Western American city of San Francisco, California, suffered a huge earthquake on April 18, 1906. More than 3,000 people are known to have died. The true number of dead will never be known. 250,000 people lost their homes. Just a few hours after the terrible earthquake, a magazine named Collier's sent a telegraph message to the famous American writer Jack London. They asked Mr. London to go to San Francisco and report about what he saw. He arrived in the city only a few hours after the earthquake. The report he wrote is called The Story of an Eyewitness. Here is Doug Johnson with the story.
Not in history has a modern city been so completely destroyed. San Francisco is gone. Nothing remains of it but memories and a few homes that were near the edge of the city. Its industrial area is gone. Its business area is gone. Its social and living areas are gone. The factories, great stores and newspaper buildings, the hotels and the huge homes of the very rich are all gone. Within minutes of the earthquake, the fires began. Within an hour, a huge tower of smoke caused by the fires could be seen 100 miles away. And for 3 days and nights, this huge fire moved in the sky, reddening the sun, darkening the day, and filling the land with smoke. There was no opposing the flames. There was no organization, no communication. The earthquake had smashed all the modern inventions of a 20th century city. The streets were broken and filled with pieces of fallen walls. The telephone and telegraph systems were broken, and the great water pipes had burst. All inventions and safety plans of man had been destroyed by 30 seconds of movement by the earth. By Wednesday afternoon, only 12 hours after the earthquake, half the heart of the city was gone. I watched the huge fire. It was very calm. There was no wind. Yet, from every side, wind was pouring in upon the city. East, west, north, and south, strong winds were blowing upon the dying city. The heated air made a huge wind that pulled air into the fire, rising into the atmosphere. Day and night, the calm continued, and yet, near the flames, the wind was often as strong as a storm.
There was no water to fight the fire. Firefighters decided to use explosives to destroy buildings in its path. They hoped this would create a block to slow or stop the fire. Building after building was destroyed. And still the great fires continued. Jack London told how people tried to save some of their possessions from the fire.
Wednesday night, the whole city crashed and roared into ruin, yet the city was quiet. There were no crowds. There was no shouting and yelling. There was no disorder. I passed Wednesday night in the path of the fire. In all those terrible hours, I saw not one woman who cried, not one man who was excited, not one person who caused trouble. Throughout the night, tens of thousands of homeless ones fled the fire. Some were wrapped in blankets. Others carried bedding and dear household treasures. Many of the poor left their homes with everything they could carry. Many of their loads were extremely heavy. Throughout the night, they dropped items they could no longer hold. They left on the street clothing and treasures they had carried for miles. Many carried large boxes called trunks. They held on to these the longest. It was a hard night, and the hills of San Francisco are steep. And up these hills, mile after mile, were the trunks dragged. Many a strong man broke his heart that night. Before the march of the fire were soldiers. Their job was to keep the people moving away from the fire. The extremely tired people would arise and struggle up the steep hills, pausing from weakness every 5 or 10 feet. Often, after reaching the top of a heartbreaking hill, they would find the fire was moving at them from a different direction. After working hour after hour through the night to save part of their lives, thousands were forced to leave their trunks and flee. At night, I walked down through the very heart of the city. I walked through mile after mile of beautiful buildings. Here was no fire. All was in perfect order. The police patrolled the streets, and yet it was all doomed, all of it. There was no water. The explosives were almost used up, and two huge fires were coming toward this part of the city from different directions. 4 hours later, I walked through this same part of the city. Everything still stood as before, and yet there was a change. A rain of ashes was falling. The police had been withdrawn. There were no firemen, no fire engines, and no men using explosives. I stood at the corner of Kearney and Market Streets in the very heart of San Francisco. Nothing could be done. Nothing could be saved. The surrender was complete. It was impossible to guess where the fire would move next. In the early evening, I passed through Union Square. It was packed with refugees. Thousands of them had gone to bed on the grass. Government tents had been set up. Food was being cooked, and the refugees were lining up for free meals. Late that night, I passed Union Square again. Three sides of the square were in flames. The square with mountains of trunks was deserted. The troops refugees, and all had retreated. The next morning, I sat in front of a home on San Francisco's famous Nob Hill. With me sat Japanese, Italians, Chinese, and Negroes. All about were the huge homes of the very rich. To the east and south of us were advancing two huge walls of fire. I went inside one house and talked to the owner. He smiled and said the earthquake had destroyed everything he owned. All he had left was his beautiful house. He looked at me and said, "The fire will be here in 15 minutes. Outside the house, the troops were falling back and forcing the refugees ahead of them. From every side came the roaring of flames, the crashing of walls, and the sound of explosives. Day was trying to dawn through the heavy smoke. A sickly light was creeping over the face of things. When the sun broke through the smoke, it was blood red and small. The smoke changed color from red to rose to purple. I walked past the broken dome of the City Hall building. This part of the city was already a waste of smoking ruins. Here and there through the smoke came a few men and women. It was like the meeting of a few survivors the day after the world ended.
The huge fires continued to burn on. Nothing could stop them. Mr. London walked from place to place in the city, watching the huge fires destroy the city. Nothing could be done to halt the firestorm. In the end, the fire went out by itself because there was nothing left to burn. Jack London finishes his story.
All day Thursday and all Thursday night, all day Friday and Friday night, the flames raged on. Friday night saw the huge fires finally conquered, but not before the fires had swept 3/4 of a mile of docks and storehouses on the waterfront. San Francisco at the present time is like the center of a volcano. Around this volcano are tens of thousands of refugees. All the surrounding cities and towns are jammed with the homeless ones. The refugees were carried free by the railroads to any place they wished to go. It is said that more than 100,000 people have left the peninsula on which San Francisco stood. The government has control of the situation, and thanks to the immediate relief given by the whole United States, there is no lack of food. The bankers and businessmen have already begun making the necessary plans to rebuild this once beautiful city of San Francisco.
That's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.